The just one point about the title. So people, it's an eye-catching title, but I think the best comment that was made about this title today was tomorrow yesterday, was somebody came to me and said, "Tomorrow is pitching." That was the best comment that I got. So today is catching and tomorrow is pitching. That's the best that I heard. What I first would like to do before we actually start, and I would like to start, I guess, post Tanakh, beginning of the Bayis Sheni. But I was thinking before we would actually start with the history itself, I think just to go through a little bit about, let's say, why study history and what's so unique and special about Jewish history. Let me do one more. So this is a list. Probably, if you went to any class and you know anybody about history, what's the gain? What do we gain from studying history? So this is a list, and it's an important list, and it's a valid list of why study history. So you could, you know, there is a gain of history to know. It's important to know where you're from and where you got. There's a connecting of the past to the present. What else did I see? Instilling a sense of continuity. We're not here just today. We didn't come onto the scene, you know, just yesterday. But we've been here a long time. We're like the Jewish people is the oldest people in the world today. The beauty of Jewish heritage, Jewish identity. It's also you'll learn out from history why is it important to be a Jew, and inspiring through miracle of Jewish history. There's miracles. King Louis, the ninth, I'm not sure, but he was the one that killed all the Jews and were persecuted. So he was very close to the Pope, and he asked his Pope, is there a modern miracle? So the Pope said back to him, the modern miracle of today, and that day in the 1700s, was look at the Jewish people, because the miracle of their survival, they shouldn't be around, and yet here the Jewish people are, and they're alive and kicking. It's not like they're just a small little, minor type of a people, but they are in the forefront, as we'll see a little bit more. And of course, this is a very famous quote of George Santayana, who say, "Those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it." You don't learn history, you know. That's a very famous quote, and you always see. I've seen the quote with pictures of book burnings or pictures of like bad things happening, and that's, you don't learn what happened, and it'll happen again. History could serve as a lesson for the future. So these are all important things. I think we'll get to it. What I think is really unique about Jewish history, and Jewish history really starts from the Torah. From the Torah, that's really the Tanakh is in a certain sense a history book. It's not a history book like you would find in any library, because it's missing major things. It's not like what you would expect to see in a history book. But it is a history book. You know, it's more than that, of course. But we use that, we know a lot, and everybody, all historians and archaeologists and everybody, they all use the Tanakh. You can't ignore it, and they have to deal with it. And so what is it in the Tanakh that was, you know, what is it that we, when we have the Torah, the Nevi'im, the Ksuvim, when we have, what do we have as it? What do we gain from it? In what way does it help us? So I think that, first of all, we see when you use the Torah as a history book, first of all, you should know, like, think about it there. You know, how many dates does the Torah give us? You know, like, you know, the first thing is when I was in history, you know, the first question that's asking for three, you know, hello teacher, yes, do we have to know the dates? Dates important. People important. And the truth is, it's really in terms of Jewish history, in terms of what we want to gain out of Jewish history, dates are really not important. It is important to a certain sense to know when things are, but when we're trying to, hopefully we'll get from Jewish history, are things beyond dates. We're not really looking for dates. We're looking for lessons, as we all know we learn from the Torah. One thing you see from the Torah, and let's say a certain hashkafa you get from Jewish history, is that individuals count. It's the individual that is important. As you see over here, Karl Marx, in his book and his philosophy on life, his philosophy on life was that there are certain forces in history and the individual doesn't matter. It's going to happen anyway, and that's it. There's nothing you can do about it. That's probably why we have many, you take a look now and you see many people in terms of voting, you know, let's say you take in terms of, even today, people say they get a feeling, it's not going to, what's my vote going to make a difference? What could I do? What's special about me? Forget it, it's going to happen anyway, and everything is worthless. But the Torah teaches us it's not so. I just put over here, let's say, one or two or three examples. There are many more, we could probably look at it. But if you take a look at, take a look at the story of the of Mitzrayim. Right? How does the Torah record the Jews, the Mitzrayim experience, if you would? So what happens? The Torah tells us that there's this family, the Avinu family, Yaakov and his sons, and there's a little discord between the brothers, and Yosef ends up getting sold, and the focus of the story is about Yosef. And Yosef goes ahead and he gets to jail, and he gets out of jail, interprets a few dreams, and before you know it, he's number two. The brothers come down to Mitzrayim, and there's a reunion. And then it mentions how Yosef saves the entire world. Now, if you were writing that in history, how would you really record that? I mean, the whole world was turned over. There was a famine in the whole world, and everything was, there was a tremendous upheaval. Everybody was coming into Mitzrayim. There was no food in the world, and Mitzrayim, whatever, it was always a superpower, but it became the biggest power, maybe the only major country in the world. And if you want to record it in the history, you're recording it from the history in the terms, in the eyes of maybe a Yosef or a very small family. And the Torah does this. You could even go to this last week, Kings and Five Kings. And how does the Torah record it? Through the eyes of Avram Avinu. And not even as, you know, the big five. It doesn't mention anything on how Avram beat the four kings or anything. It's all gone through the eyes of Avram Avinu. So everything is recorded in the sense of an individual, in the sense of people. People make difference. People is what's important, at least in Jewish history. Not only are people important, what people do is important. The Torah not only does it count what people do, but it counts, let's say, steps. And this is also a difference. When we have in terms of history, what's going to happen in history. Things of schusim, whether or the way a person acts now, is going to make a difference in history. Nebuchadnezzar, the Gemara tells us that Nebuchadnezzar was he started his career as secretary of what you would call it, of the writing. You know, they used to write letters, so the king would want to write a letter to another king, so it was a scribe. So he was the king's personal scribe. And the story goes with Yecheskel. Yecheskel is the king, and he asks Hashem for a sign. And Chizkiyo is the king, and he asks Yeshaya for a sign. And Yeshaya says, well, what would you like? You want the sun to go ahead 3 hours or back 3 hours? So Chizkiyo says, go ahead, 3 hours is not such a big deal. Why don't we move the time back 3 hours? And he does. Meanwhile, back on the other side of the world is a king, I think his name was Baladan, in Syria, all the way out in Assyria, in Aram. He takes a nap, and he wakes up, and it's earlier than when he went to sleep. So he was upset, because he thought, I don't know why we think this way, but he thought he slept an entire day, because how is it possible I go to sleep? I guess it was before the time of planes, right? So he wakes up, and he wakes up before he went to sleep, so he's upset with all his servants. And he is just, he's saying, what's going on here? How could you let me sleep so long? And they said, no, relax. You didn't sleep so long. The sun moved back 3 hours. Now, I don't know how they knew, but the Tanakh, or the Medrash brings down that they knew that, he said, it must be because of Chizkiyahu and his God. They do things like this, you know, move suns and things. So the king says, yeah, there's a king that does this. And he says to the scribe, I want you to send a letter of greeting to Chizkiyahu, king of Yehuda. And he does. And the scribe, now it just so happened that either Nebuchadnezzar, who was this king's scribe at the time, was either on a lunch break or he's on vacation, but the scribe who was there wrote the letter, and he said to the king of Yehuda, Chizkiyahu, and to the God of the Jews. And he wrote the letter and whatever Baladan wrote and sent it to Chizkiyahu. And this is, if you're familiar with the Nach, they come and Chizkiyahu shows him things in the Beis HaMikdash, which is some things he shouldn't have done. But okay. Now, Nebuchadnezzar got off his coffee break or came back from vacation. I guess he's looking over the letters that were sent out, and he says, oh my gosh, there's something wrong with this letter. Because it said, the letter addressed to the king of Judah, Chizkiyahu, and to the God of Israel. And that's not the proper protocol. How do you put the king before the God? So what does he do? He takes 3 steps to go ahead to bring the letter back. 4 steps, 4 steps, but he said it takes 4 steps to bring the letter back and stops. He realizes, I'm not going to get the letter back. With these steps, he was zocha to rule the world for 3 generations. Those steps. Kadosh Baruch Hu counts steps. Steps. He took a step. And very similar, maybe a more familiar example that we have is with Eglon. This is in the Shoftim period. So Eglon was the king of Moab. He was happened to have been a very bit large king. He was a heavy king. And he's up in, he's sitting there, and this is in the Shoftim period, and a contingent of Jews come to visit him. And among the Jews, they have one of the Shoftim, his name was Lefty. His name was Ehud, but he was a Lefty. So why is that important? Because when he went in to greet the king, they used to check the sword. They used to keep their sheaves on their left side, because if you're, you know, take your sword, pull it out, and you get killed. But Ehud was a Lefty, so he had his sword on the right side. He didn't check the right side. And anyway, after they met with the king, everybody left, and Ehud said to King Melech Eglon, he said, I have a message to you from the God of Israel. And with that, the king of Eglon stood up when he heard that. Now, the king of Eglon, of course, he was in Russia, he was terrible. In the Chazal tell us he was a very, very bad, wicked king. But he heard that it was from the God of Israel, and he stood up, and it took effort for him to stand up. It wasn't just, you know, light guy that stood up on his feet, but with the effort he stood up, and Ehud had killed him, and so on and so forth, and they didn't realize it till later, and the Nach continues. But because he stood up, because Eglon stood up, he was zocha to have a descendant of his would be Rus. Now, this is what, you know, this is, and there are countless examples of this. In a different sense, and in a certain sense, we could go really to last week's parsha as well. We could really go to last week's parsha as well. Everything that Avram did during the his first act of chesed as a Jew made a difference to all of his children in the desert. Avram went ahead and he brought them food. So the Jews were brought food. Hashem supplied food to the Jews in the desert. Avram stood over them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu stood over the Jews. Avram was sitting down, and when Hashem was there, he wanted to stand up for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem said no, and we learn how the Rashi over there says that also is like set. It was for the future that when the Sanhedrin in the future is going to sit, Hashem is going to stand over them. So this is all in today's parsha as well. We had something where Eliezer when Rivka does exactly what the condition was, is to give him water and then give the camels. So he immediately gives her a necklace, two bracelets, and 10 measures of gold. And that, Chazal tell us, that was to signify, was a simon for the luchos, two luchos, the 10 commandments. So this is also, all these acts and things are also counted in the Tanakh. So first thing is that Hashem counts. Individuals count, and acts that individuals count as well. And just the next thing. Another thing about Jewish history is that world history, is only because of the Jews. Now, you really could say that world history, everybody would agree, world history is really Jewish history, because, but it's even more than that. It's not only is world history Jewish history, but really the entire history of the world really is because of the Jews. And I just have a few examples here. This is probably the one thing that, like, when I was in high school, elementary school, high school, you know, when you're taught, so first of all, the bad guys are the good guys, and has nothing, it's totally divorced from Jews. For example, I'll give you one example, the Crusades. You know, when I was taught Crusades in high school, there's no mention of the Jews, what they did to the Jews, and they glorified it. People for their cause, for their beliefs, they traveled everywhere across the world, and they saw a different lifestyle, and they brought things back, and that led to the people wanting more, and led to the Reformation, and like, etc. And here we are because of this, and it's taught in a vacuum, and like, you know, what does it have to do with us? But in reality, not only is Jewish world history, but it really is Jewish history, and even more so, it's only because of the Jews. I give you one example. One example, Chazal tell us, it is a line in Bamidbar, and it says that Amun Moav Tiro B'Sicha. What does that mean? So, what happened is the Jews were promised the land of the seven Canaanites, right? The seven nations. And the Jews were given those lands. Now, in reality, there were 10. Avram was told 10. But for whatever reason, because of certain sins, 3 were not given over. 2 were given to Lot, Ammon and Moab. 1 was given to Esau, which is Edom. So the Jews only were going to get 7 out of the 10, and the other 3 weren't going to the Jews. Now, not only that, in addition, the Jews were given another restriction. And not only were you not going to get the other 3, but you can't even attack them. Ammon and Moab were off limits. And they can't marry into Klal Yisrael because they didn't greet us with bread and water, and they hired Bilam to kill us. But we are not allowed to attack Ammon and Moab. So what happened? Ammon and Moab, I guess, somehow ended up on what today is Jordan. Aver Hanan, the other side of the river. With today's present Jordan. Now, I guess Hashem wanted to give it to us. But there's a problem. We can't attack Ammon and Moab, right? Ammon and Moab, that's off limits. We can't attack it. That's going to Lot. Those countries we can't attack. So what did Hashem do? Hashem created a war between another country, Sichon, who's the king of the Amori. And there was a war between Sichon and Ammon and Moab. Sichon won the war. they get a tremendous amount of land, and the Amonimo is pushed more east. But what that opens up is the entire land of Jordan. All of a sudden, a few years later, the Jews come by, and we come up around. We make a wide end run around Israel because of the Chet of the Meraglim, and the first country we meet is Sichon, followed by Og, and we take that land. So there was a war that happened before. Maybe the Jews were still in slaves in Egypt. You know, there was a war going on in the Middle East. You know, some things never change, right? So there was a war going on in the Middle East, and what was the purpose of that war? Why was there a war going on? The war was only going on, you think, because Sichon was a gibor, and Ammon and Moab, and there were personalities going on over there, and I'm sure there were, you know, people trying to flex their muscles and everything. Nothing, right? As we're going to say, as I always say, is as much as things change, things stay the same. Things just repeat themselves, and we'll see that's also part of patterns. We'll get to that in a second, shortly. But here you have a whole war going on, Ammon and Moab, and that's in these four words in the Chumash. It brings down Ammon and Moab, Tiro b'Sichon. Ammon and Moab, they were matar, they were fixed up, they were purified by Sichon. Sichon beat them, they got rid of Ammon and Moab for us, so to speak. The Jews come by, and we're able to get much more land because we are allowed to attack Sichon, and we are allowed to take over Sichon. Just want to skip to the next one. Just another thing. Let's say in terms of history. This is an example. I'm maybe going back and forth. In 1917, England made something called the Balfour Declaration. Is everybody familiar with the Balfour Declaration? Is right. So the Balfour Declaration made a tremendous impression on the Jewish people. Made a tremendous impression on the world. But the impression was that Her Majesty is fit, or it's okay if the Jews would have a homeland in Palestine. I even heard something that when the Chafetz Chaim heard it, he put on his Shabbos suit. You know, just it was a tremendous, tremendous impression on the Jews. Now, of course, the British, they knew how to cover themselves, because the first paragraph said that the Jews can have their homeland. The second paragraph said that if there are people there that don't like it, they can't get it. So the Jews read the first paragraph, the Arabs read the second paragraph. But that's not the point. The point is why did they do it? They did, and this is before why they did it. But what that was is that all of a sudden it gave us a tremendous impetus, where there was a major power in the world that agreed, or somehow gave its haskama, gave its agreement, gave its support to a Jewish homeland, and it had tremendous, tremendous effects on the Jewish people. Many of the Jewish people. Religious, not religious, it changed. It made a why did they do it in 1917? Because they wanted the Jewish support during World War I. In order to get Jewish support in World War I, so they came out with this document. You see, at that time when they had the document, they did not have Palestine. How did the British end up with Palestine? Because I think it was Churchill himself had a great plan, you know, instead of attacking Germany and Italy across Europe, why don't we attack the Middle East, come through the Middle East, come up through Turkey into Italy, and we'll attack that way. Now, the plan was like the craziest plan in the world. But after World War One, what happened? There was a Balfour Declaration, and who ended up with Palestine? The British. It's an amazing thing, and that is something that led to the state of Israel. Now, for good or for bad, I'm not talking in terms of but this is what it was. This is the impression that it did. Now, so you could ask, what was the whole purpose of World War One? Of course, there are many purposes, many reasons, but if you want to even go further than that. Great Britain always was, for the last 600-700 years, they were always the balance of power. It was France and Germany were at it for each other for 600 years. They were always fighting with each other. Great Britain, England, they always sided with the weaker one. So when they felt France was stronger, they sided with Germany, and they fought France. When they felt France was weaker, then they sided with France against Germany. So you can probably now trace England's involvement in all of Europe all the way back up until we get to today. So again, when you say you can make a claim, you can say that the whole European history was really because of the Jews. We're looking here back in 2010. You know, we see that the Jews ended up with the state of Israel had they ended up with this, and you can make the claim is that the whole history was all to get to that spot. I heard a very nice word in Shmoneh Esrei, right? So we make the bracha Bli Rishlayim Mircha, and that bracha of Shmoneh Esrei, how do you end off the bracha? Bracha to Hashem Bonei Yerushalayim. So Bonei Yerushalayim means Hashem is the builder of Jerusalem, right? But it's said in the present, Bonei Yerushalayim. Hashem is building Yerushalayim. So we can make that bracha today, because Baruch Hashem, you go to Eretz Yisrael today, you see Yerushalayim, you see Rubenstein owns the whole Jerusalem. You see his big, you know, cranes all over, buildings are all over the place. So today we're making the bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem, Bonei Yerushalayim. We see it with our own eyes. For the past maybe 200 years, you could say that also. We see Yerushalayim. Things are starting and getting bigger and bigger. What about 300 years ago? 400 years ago? 5, 6, 7, 9. This is the same bracha. We didn't change the girsa. 6, 7, 800 years ago, we're making the bracha Bonei Yerushalayim. So how were they able to make the bracha? Of in the present, Hashem is building Yerushalayim. And the answer is, Hashem is building Yerushalayim. He's taking the forces of history, and he has to move this country here and have them attack here and build this. Still here until finally, and then you know, World War One and World War Two, and all of a sudden, Bonei Yerushalayim. But it started. You could probably trace it all the way back to the Churban. So that's in a global sense. Again, Tanakh world history is only because of the Jews. There's a story that I heard from Rabbi Wine. He has a on his tape. It's an unbelievable story. It says. He brings down in 1964 Pope Paul VI decided he wants to visit what was then Jordan. Okay, so again, this is in 1964. It was the state of Israel, and it was Jordan, and the entire West Bank was part of Jordan. Jerusalem was split down the middle. Western Jerusalem was part of the Jews, and Eastern Jerusalem was part of the was with the Arabs. So he decided he was going to come into, he was going to fly into Amman. This was the itinerary, and he was going to go into the West Bank. He was going to come to Shechem, and from Shechem, he was going to come down into Jerusalem, and from Jerusalem, he was going to go from East Jerusalem into West Jerusalem, make a visit into Israel. I don't know if he was going to fly out of Tel Aviv or go back, but that was his planned route. He never made it to West Jerusalem. He never made it to Israel. He made it to East Jerusalem and made a few more stops and then flew back home. Problem was, he was going to cancel his trip. And the reason is because from, I think it was Megiddo or whatever, but we're from Shechem, basically, to Jerusalem. There wasn't a road. It was the same donkey path that Avram Avinu traveled down. It was so if the Pope wanted to go from the north, come down to Jerusalem, he'd have to get on a donkey. There was no way for cars to go through. So what happened is I don't know how, whatever, but the United States found out about it. And the United States, their Department of International Development, whatever that department is called, found out about this and said, "Oh, wow, this can't be. How could the Pope go on a donkey path?" So what did they do? They took, I wasn't born yet, but they took many of your money, and they took it and they built the road in taxpayer money. They went ahead and they built the road in Israel. They built the road from Shechem down to Yerushalayim so that the Pope can go ahead and drive in a car. And that's what he did. That's what they did. Now, that's the history. That's 3 short years later, in the Six-Day War, the Israelis broke through Jenin. They didn't break through into Jerusalem. They broke through in Jenin. The triangle, there was an iron triangle, whatever. And they came in, as soon as they got through into Jenin, like they got in very quickly, they found a beautiful big highway. They got six tanks on that highway like this. Within a half an hour, they had surrounded Jerusalem. And they had the most of the Jordanian army that didn't get out in time, that most of them got out, they got all the way pushed back to Jericho. I ask you, why was that road built? Who was that road built for? Was it built for the Pope, or was it built for the Jews? That's just another example. And you could probably, if we're all alert, you could probably do this with any type, anything in history. You take a look at in the first Scud War, the first Iraq War, right? So what did the Iraqis do? They first made the mistake of attacking Kuwait. And, they first made the mistake of attacking Kuwait. And then they shot missiles to Eretz Yisrael. They first got the whole world upset with them. And then they shot missiles to Eretz Yisrael. What they should have done, they should have first shot missiles to Eretz Yisrael. Then they got the whole world on their side. Then they could have taken Kuwait. But, again, Hashem is running the world, and he knew how to get everything. You could do this with everything. You could do this today with internally and everything. You see how is it affecting the Jews. How does everything happen with the Jews? Somebody also told me, and I wouldn't be able to find, I don't know if this is true because I don't have a subscription to the New York Times, but they said, I heard it on the first page, but I can't believe it's the first page, but at least in the first section of the New York Times, in the past 70, 80 years, since the State of Israel, Israel has been in the New York Times first section every 3 days. In other words, it hasn't been 3 days without Israel being in the first section. It could be negative, it could be positive. That doesn't make it, but the point is that Israel is in the front in the front of it. Just as somebody was telling me a story that they had an exchange student from China came to America. So there's 2 billion students in China. And so for him to get the scholarship, to get the exchange, he must have been very smart, right? I don't know how, unless there's protexia there like there is here. But evidently he must have been something, because he came to America as exchange, but he was here in America, and he's learning English, and he's reading the New York Times. So he happened to have been staying by a firm Jew, from family. And they had, he wasn't in New York, he was somewhere on, I think around Baltimore, that would make sense, around Washington area. And he was reading the New York Times, and he kept seeing three countries come up. And this goes back 30, 40 years ago. One country was Russia, one country was the United States, and one country was Israel. That was made it every day, the front cover was it. So what did he do? He's a new, student. So he decides, let's figure out. So he sees where the United States is, and he sees where Russia is. And he figures, okay, where would Israel be, right? So he figures, where is Israel? Figures it must be the land that's in between the United States and Russia, which means he thought it was Canada, right? Because, that's the buffer, if you're going this way over the world, that's the buffer. And he was talking with his host, this was told to me by the host. The host says he was talking with him, and the guy says, Israel, and he was talking to Israel as if it's Canada. And he said to him, he says, no, that's not Israel, that's Canada. Canada. He says, then where's Israel? He took him to a map, and he showed him a map of the the Middle East. He's looking, he says, where's Israel? He says, well, the land isn't big enough to hold the word towards Israel. If you look in the Mediterranean Sea, you'll see the word Israel, and that's where it is. So he's like looking, he says, this, he couldn't believe it. This is Israel? This is what's making the news? He says, how many people are there? So at the time, he says, I don't know, he says, 15 million people? I don't know, with the Arabs, what is it, 10, 15 million people? So he says, 10, 15 million people? So he said, there are 2 billion people plus or minus 25 million people. In other words, in China, they didn't know exactly how many people there are, 1.7 exactly what it, but there the margin of error was 25 million people. This is a good book, this is 30 years ago. He says there are more people that are lost in China, twice as many people lost in China in a statistical than there are in Israel. And this is a second thing. We'll just go to the third thing. I don't know if I'll have time to do it tonight. But number three is now I guess maybe we could pick this up. But this just shortly in just a few minutes. This has to do with the future. Another thing about Jewish history is the script is written. We just don't know it yet. But the Torah not only does it tell us the past, but we know the future. The future, we see in Hazinu. It tells us in Hazinu, this is the future. This is it. This is what we know. The Tochacha, you know, it wrote the Tochacha. You know, up until the Holocaust, people said Tochacha couldn't really be that bad, but you know, the Tochacha didn't even describe what was going on. I'm sorry, the curses. It says if the Jews don't follow the Torah, there's going to be curses in the Torah. So the Holocaust, the fulfillment of the curses, for whatever reason we don't, but the fulfillment of the curses was during the Holocaust. The Torah is it tells the future. Just as a just the next line. It just Mr. Lippert, just the next line. So just also the history. It's just as it, part of it being part of the future. We're on a journey. It's not just haphazard, okay, let's see what happens, and some nation comes and other nations go. But we're here, Hashem is controlling the world, and there's a destiny, there's an ending point. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to get to that ending point, which also brings up Ma'is Avosim and Lefanim, which there are the patterns. And this I'm just doing quickly because I just want to finish this part. There are patterns in history. One pattern is, like we mentioned with the Tocha, people do good, they get the Torah, they follow the Torah, things go good with Klal Yisrael. Pattern thing, people, they stop following the Torah, things don't go as well. You could say Ma'isa Avosim Labanim is explaining that pattern. Avram was Shachar symbolized the beginning. He comes in and he's on the rise. Everything that happens to Avram is positive. There's daylight. Everything is great. He comes. He becomes Avram on Goyim, a leader of the nations. His star is rising. Yitzhak comes in. Yitzhak is on top of the world already. He's already established, and he's extremely rich, and he's extremely, you know, everything is going great with Yitzhak. But already by Yitzhak, you already begin to see signs of problems. There are issues with the well. He has to leave a certain time, you know, he has to leave. They patch things up, but Yaakov, that's Mincha, and Yaakov, which is Meir, which is evening, which is dark, that's Golus. And the patterns, this is our pattern in history. We go to a country, they invite us in, we're welcomed with open arms, we come, we develop ourselves, and make the country great. We can give so many examples. The Jews come into a country, boom, country goes up. Holland, West Indies, they get kicked out of Spain, they go to Holland. Before you know it, Holland is in the race of imperialistic countries. They barely had a right to exist as a country in Europe, and here they are, they're in the race. Why? Jews move in there, things happen. As soon as they kick the Jews out of Spain, Spain is a steady decline down. More Jews? Worthless. So, you know, who needs you? That's a pattern. But I just want to end with this mashal. I think it's a very, very nice, interesting mashal. Super Bowl Sunday. Guy, unfortunately, is either he's busy. Either he's working, he has to go to a simcha. Maybe he's in yeshiva learning, but he can't see it. But no problem. Today's day and age, he's got TiVo. He's got it all recorded. And he makes sure he doesn't talk to anybody. He wants to enjoy this game. It's just going to be a little later. So what does he do? He drives home, and that's it. He's excited. He's going to listen, watch his game. Baruch Hashem, nobody told him anything. And that's it. So it's a little later at night. And he's in the car, and the radio goes on. He's listening to the radio, and boom, there's a... he's listening to the news, or at the end of the hour, And the news says his team that he wants to win, his team in the Super Bowl wins. And he quickly turns off the radio. All right, he comes home, and he's sitting there, and he's starting to watch. And his family knows he's interested and knows that they want this team to win and not the other team. And all of a sudden, the first quarter happens, and the other team scores a touchdown. And he is jumping for joy. The other team scores a second touchdown, and a third touchdown, and a field goal. It's 24-0. And he is jumping up for joy. And his family doesn't understand. He says, what are you jumping up for joy for? The other team is 24-0. You're losing. He says, why is he jumping up for joy? Because he knows the ending. He knows his team is going to win. That means he knows his team is going to have to score at least 25 points. And that's it. That's almost like what Jewish history is. We know there's an ending, and we know the ending is good. And here we are, you know, and some we see things happening in our day, and in Yitz Hashem, things will happen even more so. Just for next week, I just would like to, I think I'd like to start with, again, the second base of Mikdash in the beginning, the transition between coming back into Eretz Yisrael, which is called the Second Commonwealth. And now we're ready. This is, I guess if you ask me why it's exciting history, it's very personal. There's a lot of positive things going on, and there's a lot that you can all relate to us. It's not just random things going on. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is leading destiny, helping everything going up, all for us, every one of us here. Every one of us counts, and the world is all set for all of us. And now, let's Mitzvah Hashem, we're ready to start history, and maybe we can make these connections and see our learnings from ourselves. I thank everybody so much for coming.